The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. And today we're doing our first swapcast with Pod Patrol and Dr. Jeffrey Dykus.
Not Pod Patrol.
I said pod.
Oh, it's
my English as a second language, bro.
You probably wouldn't even know what Pup Patrol is, right?
I would not. Pup Patrol.
You got to have a toddler.
Okay.
It's a great show.
So we talk about the cross-pollination between podiatry and vascular surgery and our interactions and how we can make that better. And we talk about a little bit of our podcast journey.
Yeah,
an experience. So I hope you guys enjoy.
And they're airing the same, and we're airing the same, and so yes. We're just kind of swapping it up.
Yep.
Welcome to our first swapcast.
All right.
Well, apparently our next one is Rogan.
Yeah, it's on the books.
All right.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast.
And
Pop Patrol.
There you go. Our first swapcast.
Which means what to those that are out there that have no idea what?
Well, you just learned it, so what does it mean to you?
There's the lingo that we're learning, and yeah. I don't feel I'm cool enough for it. But apparently, if there is another multi-billion download view podcast that wants to share with you, and you come to an agreement, then you record, and then it's going to be aired on both channels.
There you go.
It makes sense, right?
It totally makes sense.
Yeah.
I came up with a name for us.
Which is?
Flowdiatry. This episode is called Flowdiatry.
Okay.
Do you love it or really love it?
Love it. Yeah, we should call it something funny and make it recurring. I don't know. We'll see how the chemistry goes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have the thought of pot flow.
Pot flow? Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Yeah, but flow dietary, we'll take one of those. We'll figure it out. Anyways, Jeffrey, a little intro, or how about we introduce ourselves for your audience, and then you can do the same for our audience, I guess?
Absolutely.
All right.
This is cool.
Yeah, my name is Lucas Ferrer. I'm a vascular surgeon, and I work in Austin. And yeah, I have an interest in limb salvage, basically from my residency days, and kind of Miguel was my mentor in that. And thus I give the stage to Miguel.
Miguel Montero Baker. I'm a vascular surgeon. I'm the less healthy side of this podcast, apparently.
You're the string cheating, eating side.
I still have an issue, and it'll continue to be a pet peeve with you. I don't think anybody should not like string cheese.
It's okay.
I am in private practice. My words are my own, and I don't fear anybody or retaliation.
So that means that you're going to curse a lot during this episode?
It just means I don't need that stupid message you put on every one of our podcasts to somehow absolve yourself from any issues with your corporation and academic institution.
Well, let's keep our problems with ourselves. Anyways,
we have the pleasure of our guest
Jeffrey.
I'm Dr. Jeff Dykus. I'm a podiatrist up in Iowa. I work for the largest multi-specialty clinic up here in Iowa. Did my training over in Pittsburgh at the University of Pittsburgh. I do mostly sports and reconstructive surgery. I do a lot of trauma. But historically at our program in Pittsburgh, we did a lot of limb salvage, a lot of Charcot recon, a lot of interaction with vascular. In residency, I spent a month on vascular as a student, a couple weeks on vascular. So we kind of dip our toe in the water in terms of our involvement with vascular. And that's where our kind of, deep understanding ends. And then at this point, it's a lot of handoffs. It's a lot of me ordering arterial ultrasounds and trying to figure out what candidates might make sense to involve vascular from my standpoint. So I'm excited to get together today, guys.
Yeah. So sure, we decided that we're going to talk a little bit about the clinical nuts and bolts tactical aspect of our interactions between vascular and podiatry. What do you think is kind of like an area where podiatrists and vascular surgeons, either there's a gap in between how we function or how we interact?
Yeah, so I always try to talk to my local vascular surgeons and figure out what they want me to do. How much testing do they want me to order before I try to figure out, okay, does this patient need intervention or not? And so at this point, and I don't know what your guys' thoughts are, I don't do ABIs. I'm not a huge fan of ABIs. I get arterial ultrasounds. And then at that point, you know, I don't interpret that test. So it's up to the radiologist to tell me if they're monophasic, triphasic, whatever they might be, and refer them off to vascular. And then that's where kind of the brick wall hits. And then I kind of don't know what happens after that. So I think it's interesting from our side of it to understand what you guys would want us to do when we have a patient who either has a non-healing wound, non-healing surgical incision, gangrenous toe, I'm going to amputate. I want to know the level of flow and what, you know, what the likelihood of that healing is or a TMA. But what are your guys' thoughts on what you want when someone walks in the door to be a potential vascular candidate?
I think one, you know, before we even kind of dissect that very astute question is the fact that I do believe that these two specialties should just coexist in whatever of the most functional capacities possible.
Yeah.
You know, my background of coming from the U of A and working with David Armstrong, who probably resonates significantly with the podiatric community at the global level, was that, you know, essentially the foot consult, the red foot or the hot foot, has this matrix that can either go, podiatry should run with the ball or vascular should run with the ball first. And it has to do with this question that you're posing about, what is it, you know, what's the basis of the vascular condition there? But the fact that these two teams are in there, in that moment, I think is probably the first thing that we have not necessarily done really well. My experience is, depending on what hospital I go to, I may or may not get good podiatric care, or I may or may not get good response from the podiatric surgeons, or there may or may not be some politics involved. Or there may or may not be, and probably the same thing happens the other way, right? Where there is maybe not cohesiveness or communication. And certainly having them work within the same tax ID, which is, for example, what we do, where we have podiatry and vascular under the same roof, that's even less frequent. I'd love to just take a minute or two to get your thoughts here, Jeffrey, as to why is it that has not become the norm that we're all together, and or that is just the absolute way that we should be working, even though every paper for the last 15 years about multidisciplinary care with these two particular specialties leading the cause has shown us that the best results come from that cohesiveness, but yet we just can't achieve it.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So at my hospital, I work in a critical access hospital. We don't have vascular surgery. So there's literally the out of sight, out of mind component of it, or just the difficulty of crossing paths. A lot of medicine, maybe less so these days with text messaging and, you know, this or video calls or whatever you want to say. A lot of medicine happens when you see someone. Oh, hey, I got a patient I want to run by you. And so a lot of that happens face to face, person to person. But one of the barriers to that is that I physically just don't have vascular surgery in my hospital. So all of my patients who I think need vascular are going to be an external referral to a hospital 45 minutes away. Mm. So there are barriers to entry from patient transportation, maybe insurance, maybe not. But one of the components is just physical limitations of that interaction. The other component is I don't know that that's only limited to podiatry and vascular. I think that's a limitation across medicine. I think medicine works best for the patient when there is interaction between all the specialties. I found that it worked really, really well in residency when I was on a service and I knew one of the residents on ortho or plastics or vascular, and I knew them personally. I could just pick up the phone, and it was very easy for us to coordinate all those things.
100%.
Once you get to the attending level, for some reason, we lose that a little bit. Mm-hmm. I try not to do that. I text other specialties all the time. Hey, I have this. What are you thinking about that? But those are the two reasons I can think is that number one, it's just not the norm. And number two, there's a barrier where my patients don't even interact with vascular very easily.
Yeah, is there financial issues there?
As far as what?
As far as why we don't work better together? I don't think so. I've tried to think about what could be the disincentive. Like,
yeah, I don't think so.
Feel that there is
I think there's a lack of the
structure. My cynicism drives me to think that money is always reason, but I don't think so because
I think it's the structure. It's the structure of the team. It's not built as a team. It's built as silos. So then there's an inherent discontinuity in between medicine, podiatry, vascular, rheumatology. We all operate in silos. So it's not a team taking care of a patient. It's multiple teams interacting, taking care of that patient. So it's just built wrong. The whole model is wrong.
Especially on an outpatient basis. In the hospital, mm-hmm. I think it's a little easier for specialties to coordinate. Outpatient, I mean, definitely, I 100% agree with you that we're siloed. Hey, make an appointment with them. Then you'll make an appointment with them. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of nobody stays in touch. Oh, maybe I'll forward my letter. I'll forward my last note over so they can read it. But it's not good communication between the specialties.
We also don't create enough spaces for that to happen. The only meeting that sort of kind of does a little bit of this is DEF CON. Mm-hmm. Maybe Jeff knows another one, but there's really no place where the toe and flow model is perpetuated, nurtured, built upon. I mean, at this point, we should have blueprints of how to build practices because I believe that these are actually pretty good financial models of symbiotic relationships where if you put them all in the same tax ID, they're A, protected by group practice models so they can refer and counter refer as many billion times as possible. There's no problems. Mm-hmm. And there could be financial incentives for podiatrists to do things and to get bonus structures built into their models that are stuff that they could never do on themselves. Yeah. And for vascular surgeons, they get a perfect stream of patients secured. Yeah. I mean, I just don't understand why it has not taken off. Why somebody hasn't packaged this in a way that could just become a mantle of care across America. It just is, no, I don't know.
There's a few examples. Obviously, you're one of them. And then Dr. Armstrong and what he's doing. So for my listeners who know who Dr. Armstrong is, but don't know what that model is, because you were there, can you talk a little bit of how vascular and podiatry was integrated in that SALSA model?
Yeah. So this was a few years ago in the University of Arizona. The Southern Arizona, Southern Arizona Limb Salvage Alliance?
Yeah,
South Arizona Limb Salvage Alliance, I think, is SALSA. And so the idea here was that you would have a combined service that would take care of the hospital for anything that was foot related. And this, you know, the alarm or the, you know, the pager would ring from the moment the patient was in the ED or at any point in time. It could be activated by any team member. It could be a physician. It could be a nurse that would pick up on a, on an ingrown nail or something that looked inappropriate or inadequate. And then we would both services essentially kind of gravitate to the patient and do an assessment. And we would, based on the first full circle to your initial question, based on the vascular exam and the podiatric exam, we would decide this is a patient that requires podiatric attention over vascular attention, or this is a patient that requires vascular attention over podiatric attention. And then that ball would be bounced back and forth a little bit because sometimes you can't really separate them. But let's say, I'll give you an example of somebody, you know, a type 1 diabetic, rather on the younger side, had attack inside their, you know, their shoe, had an infection, came with a throbbing red, you know, very, 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 you know, maybe abscess on the toe, and has, you know, triphasic waveforms on the Doppler. You can essentially palpate both the dorsalis pedis and the PT, and there was nice waveforms on the TBI. That's a patient that has an infectious disease or an infectious process, needed to be drained, needed to be a potentially removal of a toe or whatever had to be done. But there wasn't really a need for an immediate vascular intervention. Whereas on the other hand, you had maybe a older patient, had non-palpable pulses, came in with some erythema of a primarily gangrene, and then that patient required revascularization. So then we would take the lead, but then the moment that we would get the flow down to the foot, then we would bring it back to podiatry. I mean, we would both follow, both parties would follow. We would do together rounds on a daily basis. And then once the patient was revascularized, then we would decide, okay, well, podiatry, you're going to go back. What are you thinking of doing? Is this a TMA? Is this just a hallux amputation? What are you going to think? And then those patients would not only, it wouldn't finish there, but we would then see them as an outpatient, and then we would both see them, right? I would do the surveillance of the vascular stuff, and then podiatry would do the care longitudinally of that foot back into remission, shoe fitting, offloading, and all these other things that need to happen. And so it just makes too much sense. And maybe it's just because I was born into it. I was educated that way. And so for me, anything that deviates from that seems so abnormal and so unnatural and illogical.
How did they do in Germany?
Completely disjointed.
Yeah.
Completely disjointed. And vascular surgery.
Like normal then.
Like the rest of the world.
Like the rest of the world. Yeah.
But, you know, let's maybe honor the question at the beginning Jeff was asking. I send an ultrasound. What is your interpretation? What do you look on? The referral is, hey, this guy's got vascular disease, possibly. I see some gangrene. You see him, you do a duplex. What are you looking for the duplex for our podiatry audience to explain?
I would like to keep it simple. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't palpate pedal pulses, call me. Mm-hmm. If the patient's diabetic.
Well, the patient's been referred. So what do you do? What's your workup? And what? How do you?
Then I do a duplex. And based on that duplex, and toe pressures, and plus minus PATs if you have them, which most people don't. But toe pressures, duplex, that usually leads to an intervention.
Why do you... I don't think ABIs help in any way, shape,
or form. I don't think either. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think... Can you expand?
Because of the calcification and lack of compressibility of the vessels. So you're going to get an abnormally high ABI for the pathology that you know is there. So it's really, so it really can be misguiding.
So you can have false normal results is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So somebody can have a normal ankle brachial index.
Yeah.
But it's actually just a very hard calcified artery that's giving you a quote, very high pressure, but it isn't really high pressure.
Exactly.
And then you mentioned PAT in a flyby way.
Yeah.
That means pedal acceleration time. And that's something that vascular surgeons and vascular interventionalists overall don't know about. Yeah. So I would also probably infer that the same is happening with our podiatry friend. So would you mind clarifying what...
Well, you're the expert.
I'm definitely not. But pedal acceleration time is something that we've been really involved with, Jeff, here lately. One of our, one of the people that work here at Hope with us, who directs the non-invasive lab, is an RVT by the name of Jill Somerset. She's very experienced, incredibly knowledgeable, very smart, and contagiously amazing and happy. And you should probably have her as a guest, by the way.
Noted.
But she started looking at these patients and essentially she said, well, all these patients are all monophasic. And of course, we're looking for triphasic, biphasic. We know that that's pretty cool and pretty good. But what she noted, which was very astute, was, well, all these monophasic patients, some do actually okay and some do really poorly. And so her thought was, well, are there different monophasics? Like, is there an okay monophasic and is there a shitty monophasic? And do I have to be mindful of my...
No.
Well, I don't know about your podcast if you guys...
No, let's get wild.
No, Lucas likes to beep my words sometimes out. So, So essentially that was it. It was just, is there a spectrum on the monophasic side? And so the way that she was able to find the spectrum was by counting the milliseconds from the beginning of the systole to the end of the systole at the level of the waveform. So waveforms are nothing but a very, 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 very distal representation of the velocity changes in blood flow related to the contraction of the heart. So every time your heart pumps, it squeezes blood out through the aortic valve. It pushes it down all these tubes. And then that accelerates the velocity and then it decelerates. And so your blood goes, right? It's acceleration, deceleration, acceleration. But then within all the monophasics, so the question would be if it was just like almost like a lake, or was it like, which is more like peaks? And so the difference was essentially the time of the systolic progression. So if that systolic progression is very fast, under 120 milliseconds, then that talks about a very peaky, very fast, almost pulsatile monophasic signal. Whereas the other one is, again, very tardus parvus. It's a very sluggish. And so the seconds are very slow. It takes up to 400 or more milliseconds to have that. And so that's what pedal acceleration time is. And so she came up with this whole thing and she measures it in multiple places in the foot, lateral plantar artery, dorsalis pedis, the arcuate artery, which is the connecting artery between the lateral plantar and the dorsalis pedis. And based on all of that, there's this, there's this really beautiful picture of hemodynamics in the foot that allow us to make very critical decisions. And what's even more cool is that some data suggests that people with pedal acceleration time of one of the lower classes, meaning the faster ones, meaning the more peaky ones, actually don't need very, very complex interventions. And so it's helped us tease out, and instead of going from just a very black and white decision to revascularize or not, or cut or not, or amputate or not, we now have more of a gray scale to understand how much we can do. And it's really important because a lot of these patients, as you both know, are very sick and very complex. And so it's nice to have some degree of hemodynamics in a world where the only thing we have is this ankle brachial index that sucks, that gives us some degree of direction. And so I think that those conversations become really important. And then when you, to your point, again, long tangent to get back to the question, when you send that out, I think it's great when that answer is not just a piece of paper or a note. I love to communicate and to have the conversation and to go into the weeds about, listen, the lateral plantar is out, the DP is in, the arcuate is in, but, you know, what are you thinking? You know, I'm looking at this guy's got 4 and 5th. Do you think that you're going to need a TMA? Do you think you're going to cut back? Do you have enough flap? You know, are there any other issues that are going to be threatening to the wound, like renal failure and or, you know, hemoglobin A1C are out of whack? Like, what do we do in order to make this happen? And then what time frame do we have? And so I think that may be helpful. Jeff, and I think you're going to start seeing and hearing more about that in coming years. I think people will get better at that and will it will help us all speak one language when we're talking about these patients.
So those are measured via ultrasound with the same arterial ultrasound that I'm ordering, or is that a separate above and beyond thing that she's doing?
It's a great question. It's the same ultrasound, but it's taking it a step forward, like to the next level. So most RVTs will stop maybe in the distal third of the leg, and nobody's ever looked at the foot. And so what she's trying to do is, well, she's not trying, she's proven that looking in the foot at the arteries, at the pedal vessels, gives enough information to make that decision much more judicious. What is lacking, and hopefully we will figure out how to get there, is, as you know, nothing in America works unless there's a CPT code that'll back it up.
Yeah.
Because this implies time, right? It adds minutes, you know, let's say that's 15, 20 minutes to your arterial duplex, which at the end of the day can, you know, be a lot of strain on an RVT. And so we need to make sure that there is some modifier of some sort or something that we could bill for so we can continue adopting and educating. Thus far, the people that have been adopting it and training it are really just highly specialized centers that get it. But I hope that we can globalize this and that the data is overwhelming to why you need to look at the hemodynamics of the foot, not to the ankle. I mean, from the ankle, you can have somebody with normal hemodynamics at the ankle level that have severe pedal disease, and you'll never find it out.
Yeah.
Unless you go past the ankle and see what's going on. And we see that more and more. Diabetics have a very different pattern of disease, and the more complex diabetics we get, the worse weird pedal loop disease we're going to stumble
on. And their genetic background. Like, you know, a diabetic, a Caucasian diabetic is not the same as a Central American diabetic. The disease processes are different, and so the presentation is different. So, yeah.
Hey guys, this is Miguel and Lucas, and we wanted to talk to you about a super interesting project.
Name of this project is Amputation Nation. It's going to be a 6-part documentary series, and we definitely want you to look at it, watch it, digest it, support it.
So visit amputationnation.org to support and give love to these people that are doing a great job.
Without a doubt, we're underdiagnosing peripheral arterial disease. It has not gotten the attention that it should.
Every 4 minutes, there is an amputation in this country due to PAD and diabetes. We also know that 85% of these amputations are preventable.
There is good care available here. Closed minds are what we have to get rid of.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because there are times where I'm looking at a foot, usually a toe, And I can see clear as day that there's gangrenous changes or just does not look like a healthy, normal toe. And I'll get an arterial ultrasound. I'll come back triphasic or at least biphasic. Looks fine.
Yeah.
And then I'm kind of stuck because if I try to refer this patient to vascular, they're going to look at the report and be like, nah, it looks fine. I don't need to see him. But I'm looking at the foot saying, something's going on here. I don't know if it's, you know, reconstructable or if I should just chop this thing off and hope or what. But I think that is one of the limitations of some of those studies is that sometimes a clinical picture that I'm seeing in front of me is not represented by the vascular testing.
Yeah. And that's kind of where the simple, you know, notion of is there a pulse? If there's not a pulse, it's not normal. It doesn't matter what the ultrasound says. Mm-hmm. There's a high likelihood that it's not normal.
You could have normal pulses in the presence of distal disease.
Yeah, but that is extremely rare.
No, I absolutely disagree with you.
Normal pulses?
You can
at the foot?
Normal pulses?
At the midfoot?
Dude, these people have swelling, edema, hyperkeratosis. Like, there's a lot of other things that get in the way that would not allow you to assess. Half of the people feel their own damn pulses on their first and second finger, right? Like,
that's true.
But it's just very, I think it's too grotesque. You need some objectivity in this. And I'll tell you that if I get a consult from the hospital and somebody's got something that's clearly some tissue issue, I'll just squirt them.
Yeah. I think you put it together. I think
I'll just squirt them. I'll think do an angiogram.
If you can get toe pressures, that's important. I think that your pulse, your physical exam is important, and the duplex is important, and you put it together. But I like to keep things simple for people that are not going to go into kind of as nuanced exam or like as nuanced evaluation of the whole thing, because you're not looking at these waveforms all the time. You're depending on radiology. So kind of keep it simple. If something seems off, then call, because I don't know, most of us like getting consults, like doing surgery.
Yeah. When in doubt.
Yeah, when in doubt, call. Kind of a deal.
So what are your thoughts on, you know, we tend to see the same patients, you know, diabetic, renal disease. There are certain subsect of population that tend to be more likely to have vascular disease, and it's fairly predictable. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on routine vascular screening versus waiting for the disease to happen? Do you think that there's a role for routine screening in some of these high-risk patients before three toes turn gangrenous and they get a TMA? Mm. Or do you think that that's not financially responsible and we need to just wait for disease and then tackle that?
I mean, it would make sense, but what I would worry is that a lot of unnecessary vascular interventions are performed based of it. I don't think there's any need for vascular interventions in people that don't have rest pains or wounds. Mm-hmm. But on your end, on the podiatry prevention end, that would probably be very beneficial. And if we, you know, if we go into the pipe dream of lifestyle changes and nutrition and all that stuff, then that would be ideal.
Yeah.
But there's no CPT code for that. So, identifying these high-risk patients is important, but I don't think going ahead and opening up a tibial on somebody that has absolutely no symptoms is something we should be doing.
So what do you see that podiatrists, you wish that podiatrists knew? You know, we talked about the lack of integration of vascular and podiatry and then potentially lack of integration between other medical specialties. To my listeners, what do you wish that podiatrists new? Do you think that they're under identifying vascular disease? Do you think that they have their head in the sand? Or what do you wish that they knew or wish that they would do to help facilitate the interaction better?
I mean, from my perspective, I wish they knew how heterogeneous and how all over the place vascular care is, you know, nowadays. And it's easier said than done, and it's very easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, but I guess we're limited by the reality of our actual networks in many ways. But don't take, I've seen this a lot which is, you know, with emotional intelligence, is be hypercritical of what you're being told. You are ultimately the advocates for these patients' long-term care. And it seems to me like if you just take whatever the one guy says that's there, there may be a lot of other options and ways to help these patients.
Reading between the lines, does that mean that Dr. X is recommending a below knee amputation, right, but if you went to the guy down the street, he'd say, no way, we can save this, we can salvage that? I mean, that's a simplified explanation of understanding what else might be out there and the difference in different providers and how they treat people.
There's data from the Society of Vascular Surgery that essentially shows 100% shifts from practice to practice, meaning there are practices that do less than 5% endovascular therapy, and there are practices that do less than 5% open therapy. And at the end of the day, the patient doesn't benefit from anybody that's an all or nothing, nothing. The patient is going to always win from a group that has the capacity to be as unbiased as possible. As unbiased as possible in their approach. Knowing that you can do a bypass or that a bypass is doable doesn't mean that a bypass may be the right thing for a patient. And so I would just say, be reasonably skeptical to what you're being told. I'll use your example. I'm seeing this toe and it looks dry, and there's some, and I mean, I've kind of debrided it and it just dies back. I mean, something's off, but the duplex was biphasic and the vascular surgeon just sent you a note saying like, dude, it's normal. Like, there's nothing for me to do, but you know, something's off, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, you sent this patient for something and they're like, oh, I did an angiogram. There's nothing to do.
Yeah, that's not the case. In 2024, that's not the case. I would say something I want podiatrists to know as advocates for patients that are in underrepresented areas that are too easily referred to for a below the knee amputation is that limited forefoot disease. The first answer, I think in 2024, 95% of the time is not going to be BKA. If somebody tells you BKA for forefoot disease, call someone else. 100%. I have no problem saying that. Because close to probably 99% of the time, you know, now with deep vein arterialization, we talked to a guy from Harvard doing this traction angiogenesis. There's a lot of things you can do. It's not available everywhere, but it's available in a lot of places. And you can transfer someone.
Yeah, so do you think that's based on the skill level of the surgeon? Obviously, there's surgeons that are more comfortable doing, you know, more distal procedures, and some that just seem to, anything beyond the ankle is just, you know, unattainable for them. Is that skill level based? Is that apathy? Or I just don't have a good understanding of it. I assume it's more difficult to the further distal you get because the vessels get a lot smaller. And so is it a skill level thing, or is it just the way they were trained, or what do you think?
I think it's when you were trained, it's a big deal. Like, so if you were trained before 1990, then, and you didn't keep up, then you're not doing a lot of endovascular stuff below the knee. It's also like, what can your facility allow you to do? Like, there are people that have all the skills in the world, but don't practice in a facility that supports that type of work. And they're limited by that. And then there's all the other stuff, you know, that we can have a negative connotation about. But I would want to say that that's the minority of people. I'd say most people are limited by their scope of their training, which is a time period thing, which you can't control, and because of where you practice. So, yeah. And what do you think, Miguel?
No, I was just expand the that this is not just surgeon centric, but that you remember that there are, you know, very, very good interventional radiologists and very, very good cardiologists that do phenomenal work, but that also need to be cognizant of their limitations. And if you are one of those podiatrists that has a very tight relationship with your cardiologist or interventional radiologist, that you know that you are, again, have a healthy degree of skepticism that he or she are always looking at this problem with just one set of tools. And that when that set of tools fails, there should be always the you know, the capacity to bring in somebody that brings a different set of tools. And so not, you know, maybe, you know, 10 angiograms or 10 angioplasties may not be the best solution for your patient. I'm not saying it's not. I'm saying maybe the repetitive procedure that isn't working or that hasn't been working may be complemented appropriately so by a bypass. And they'll just never think about it or they won't have it in their purview. It doesn't mean that there isn't going to be a patient with high risk that should never get a bypass, of course. Yes, but that's the same example. If your surgeon can only operate open and doesn't know endo, then when that bypass isn't an option, then you may be the one that needs to be empowered to say we need to pivot and we may need to reach out to our interventional radiologist friends and have them consider some exuberant, complex endovascular technique. And that's it. It's just, and I feel sometimes that the podiatrists take a bit of a, you know, kind of like, you know, it's whatever they say, you know, I can't really, you know, it's not my place to opine.
Yeah. You should take, you know, all three of them out for beers, the cardiologist, the interventional radiologist, and the vascular surgeon. So you have them all on the good side. Because, yeah, if not, you're a victim because you're kind of there stuck, and kind of in the middle.
That's how the podcast started. Two vascular surgeons go to a bar.
Yes, that is true. Beer.
So you mentioned tools. So for my audience, you're talking about interventional radiology and endovascular and open. So can you briefly discuss some of the tools that you guys have available? Because, and I think generically, patients understand when I say, hey, I'll send it to vascular and they can roto-root or something out. Patients understand that. But on a more technical level, can you guys explain what the vascular options are? I assume it depends on what the disease is and what the level of disease is, but maybe on a broad scale, can you talk about some of those options that you do have?
Yeah, I mean, so you divide into open and endovascular, or open surgery and endovascular. In open surgery, I mean, something that you guys, it'd probably be helpful information for you guys to know is the status of the greater saphenous vein, because that is kind of the linchpin in combination with the functional status of the patient. But you guys can know, it's very simple to know, to order a vein mapping, and if it's above 3 millimeters, then that's a great vein. And then that you have a great option for open surgery, even though endovascular might still be first, but you have it in the back of your mind that if somebody tells you endo is not an option, or I couldn't cross, or I couldn't open it, you can say, hey, is there a target for a bypass because we have a great vein? That's easy. Greater saphenous vein, more than 3 millimeters, good. So you have, with open surgery, you have either in situ or reverse greater saphenous vein bypass. You have composite bypasses, so they don't have a very long distance of a vein in the legs. You can do a composite or join it together with something from the arm or the other leg to make it longer, reach where you need to get. then you can use prosthetics. Prosthetics have the disadvantage of lasting less, especially when you go below the knee, and of infections are being more common and probably more devastating. And then you have cadaveric grafts, which have very poor patency and last only maybe a year at best. And then you go to endovascular. And in the vascular, there's everything. I mean, I don't really think that it matters if it's a laser atherectomy, so if it's rotational atherectomy, if it's front cutting or side cutting atherectomy. I mean, all those are, you know, there's so much variety as far as what's used, how it's used, that it really kind of doesn't really matter. The data doesn't really show that one's really better than the other, that you should be using it often or at all. The thing is, can you establish patency with endovascular procedures for traditional endovascular revascularization where you're treating atherosclerosis? Now, when we were talking about before about patients that have severe diabetes, long-standing diabetes, in likely combination with end-stage renal disease, then you have something different. A lot of times you have these no-option patients that is not necessarily your typical atherosclerosis. It's more medial artery calcinosis. And then we have other options for people that were usually just offered an amputation, even though they might have had a small lesion. And so we start talking about the vein arterialization. You're going to start hearing about podiatry. It's going to be likely a big thing, distraction angiogenesis. So all these other things are going to come into the forefront. And we can do a lot for these patients. It really bothers me when somebody, just because there's a difficult tibial lesion or something, it still happens sometimes, especially in my group where people are too fast to jump into an amputation. And I think that we should be mindful of the things that we can do and try to really avoid an amputation unless it's, you know, there's sometimes it's the best thing for the patient for other reasons. But if there's nothing that would kind of lead you to conclude that the patient would be best served with an amputation, I think there's many things you can do to save that leg and keep the patient ambulating.
So why'd you guys start your podcast?
We're drunk.
You were literally in a bar? Two guys were literally in a bar?
That sounds hard.
Yeah. Actually, we were at dinner. I know when I said, I mean, it was in my mind for a while. I was telling you, hey, man, we have to start a podcast. And you kind of gave me like half-ass answer. Like, yeah, we should start it, but we never did it. But then we were in Link in Leipzig and we went to dinner. You invited me and there was like, Roberto was there, a bunch of other people were there. And
in the little Italian place?
In the little Italian place. And I was like, you know what? I want to do this more.
This is funny how I don't know this.
That's what, for me, like, it kind of like clicked. I was like, I want to do this more. I want to have more conversation with people I admire that I think are doing cool stuff, that have interesting lives. And that's kind of been, for me, why I started. And then I kind of reached out to Miguel. I think now we've been doing it for a year. And I think that, you know, like most things that I do, that was a very selfish thing. That's like, okay, I want to have this experience because I think it's cool and I get something out of it. I think for things to grow, and this is just me, I'm not talking for Miguel, but for things to grow, I think you have to give away to others. So I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, okay, why keep doing this, you know? Is it just to have these conversations? And then, you know, one thing that has come from it, I think we've gotten a bunch of free consultations from a bunch of people that...
You mean like our guests?
Like our guests, yeah. Mm-hmm. And have been super helpful. And it's like, okay, this is the why. I think the why for me right now is to create something that it's helpful for me, which is to allow me to have the flexibility and the knowledge to expand my scope just beyond surgery. So if I want to start a business, if I have an interest, if I have interest in changing type of practices, if I have information, because all these things are very obscure. So then I think now for me is to provide information for people to do that I do, what I do, that will allow them to have autonomy in their lives. And that makes sense to me at the moment, but that's just me.
How about you, Jeff?
Well, the original idea was that I wanted it to, so my wife teaches at the podiatry school here. So she's involved with students and I have students that rotate through with me. And a lot of the education I felt was pretty boring. So I thought there would be a better way to educate students. And students these days are more on Instagram. They're more quick hits. They're more, you know, short attention span. So I kind of wanted to create something that was educational, but also entertaining. And so it's me just goofing around and trying to make jokes. So there's an underlying aspect of education in there for the students that follow and residents. But basically, I just wanted to mess around and have interesting people on and talk to them. And have you guys been recognized in the wild yet? I got recognized from the podcast in the wild for the first time. I was like, all right, that's it. I did it. I'm famous.
I have not. Lucas did.
Yeah,
I went to
AMP and somebody said, hey, you do a podcast, right? It's like, yeah, I do a podcast sometimes.
Well, I guess.
Why do you do it?
What did what?
This, like, why do
I
you come?
I fucking hate it. I just do it for you, man, because I like you. So, nah. I don't know. I thought that there was an opportunity that we could be a voice that is very needed. You know, there's not a lot of forums for us to kick our shoes off and just be very intimate and talking about things and whatever that is, right? A complex case or shit, you know, a tax burden or, you know, what do I do with this extra dollar that I have? Can I invest it? Like, we're all over the place. Like, well, ours is all over the place because that's exactly what happens when two guys go to a bar or whatever, gals, right? I mean, the notion was, you know, we'll meet once a year or twice a year at some random meeting and we're all kind of busy doing slides. But then at some point we meet at the bar and we talk about everything, right? We'll talk about, oh, that new stint, oh, that new study, yada, yada. But then we'll go on to, oh, dude, I'm getting a divorce and this lawyer and this, you know. So all these conversations needed to happen a little bit more in a more socialized way, I think. And I left the hospitals and it's been a very lonely thing, you know, when you go into private practice and you're in an outpatient, it's essentially you against the world. And so you lose a lot of the touch with other colleagues. And I thought that this was a very good way for me to keep continuing, you know, my knowledge, learning new things, talking to new people, and hopefully remaining very relevant. So there's a selfish and a selfless reason. And now in retrospect, there's all these other things that have been happening rather organically that make you understand why this is actually a really good idea. You know, other markets, more developed business, have developed a lot of these in a very successful fashion. And there's not a lot of options in our end. There's just one particular group which I follow and I listen to. It's called the VAC table, but they're for me it lacks personality because it's just they have different guests and different hosts all the time, and there's a lot of scripting going on. And it seems like it's very trained, and there's a lot of industry support there that probably fuels the way that they're done. Mm-hmm. And again, not I'm a big fan. I'm not knocking them down. I'm just saying this is very different. I don't even think we compete because this is, you like us or you hate us, you listen to us all the time. You get to create a relationship with us. You know how unhealthy apparently I am and how healthy he is. You know how I think Austin is full of a bunch of hippies and is weird and it's disorganized.
And Houston's full of cancer.
And Houston is full of cancerous elements and humidity. But then there's this whole thing, you know, our people, you know, my family, I talk about my kid and my wife, and that intimacy when you're, you know, develops a relationship with the people that I think down the line will be a little bit more of what you've already experienced, which is people will come to recognize us and we will become a very influential voice that down the line can be not manufactured, but used for a lot of good. You know, that when we get to that point of mass recognition, that we can really use this platform for a lot of change. I mean, I can foresee us supporting, you know, bills, right, to improve your reimbursement, for example, for PAT. We can, you know, use this to help physicians that are seeking, you know, for example, through Paw Patrol, like, hey, do you not have somebody to help you on the podiatry and vascular? Okay, well, we have a ton of vascular people that hear us. You have a ton of podiatrists. Can we cross-pollinate? Mm-hmm. And then there's these other bigger causes that one can think of when you get to that critical mass of listeners that start becoming an opportunity for development. So very inquisitive, intellectually very enticing. And I'm just, you know, I'm just having fun. And that's the other thing. It's unburdened because, you know, it's, I mean, we do put a lot of time into it, but it doesn't drain you and it doesn't hinder you from doing what you have to do in your life. So it's unburdened, fun, and, you know, very cool thing that can maybe turn into something someday.
Yeah, I agree. Ever since I started this podcast, I've been asked to lecture multiple places. I've been flown places. I've been on other podcasts. That is a component that I did not foresee. I just wanted to be entertaining and try to keep the attention of the students and residents, teach them how to, you know, better fix an ankle fracture and why focus here or here when we're looking at an x-ray. But I think it does open a lot of doors. And I think if you talk to enough people, I've talked to Andrew Lundquist, who is the clinical director of an AI company, and they're integrating AI into notes and understanding when patients are speaking. The AI will interpret that and create a note for you to save time on the back end. I've talked to financial people. It's just really interesting to kind of broaden your horizons, and you guys are no different, because I think there is a lot of overlap between vascular and podiatry. So I appreciate you guys wanting to, like you said, cross-pollinate here. And I think it's beneficial for both, not just podiatry and vascular, but all aspects of medicine to be more interrelated and have open discussions about things. Because I think people are going to hear this episode and they're going to learn some things and they're going to maybe change how they treat their patients from a vascular standpoint. So that can't be a bad thing.
For sure.
I love it. Well, listen, thank you very much for being here with us. And it has been a true honor and a pleasure. And
hopefully we do it again. We do pod flow or what was it?
Flow dietary.
Yeah.
No. Miguel doesn't like that one.
Life. No. I'm just trying to come up with something different.
I don't know. I'm horrible.
Just trying to do my own.
Yeah. Well, ask ChatGPT.
Like, I'm trying to come up with something like that would actually not be a great idea. That's what I normally like. So like life off patrol.
Oh, there okay. You go.
All right. We're going to leave it there. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. Jeff, thank you again.
Thanks,
and,
guys.
And yeah, we'll do it again.
All right, Tomigos.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.